Today we'll do Samuel chapter 12, and then we'll move into chapter 13 and stop at verse 15a. Samuel said to all Israel, "I have listened to you in all that you have said to me, and have set a king over you. See, it is the king who leads you now. I am old and gray, but my sons are with you. I have led you from my youth until this day. Here I am. Testify against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? Testify against me, and I will restore it to you." They said, "You have not defrauded us, or oppressed us, or taken anything from the hand of anyone." He said to them, "The Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that you have not found anything in my hand." And they said, "He is witness." Samuel said to the people, "The Lord is witness, who appointed Moses and Aaron and brought your ancestors up out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore, take your stand, so that I may enter into judgment with you before the Lord, and I will declare to you all the saving deeds of the Lord that he has performed for you and for your ancestors. When Jacob went into Egypt, and the Egyptians oppressed them, then your ancestors cried to the Lord, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought forth your ancestors out of Egypt and settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God, and he sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the army of King Jabin of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. Then they cried to the Lord and said, 'We have sinned, because we have forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and the Astartes, but now rescue us out of the hand of our enemies, and we will serve you.' And the Lord sent Jerubbabel and Barak and Jephthah and Samson and rescued you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you lived in safety. But when you saw that King Nahash of the Ammonites came against you, you said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us,' though the Lord your God was your king. See, here is the king whom you have chosen, for whom you have asked. See, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and heed his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not heed the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. Now therefore take your stand and see this great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call upon the Lord that he may send thunder and rain, and you shall know and see that the wickedness that you have done in the sight of the Lord is great in demanding a king for yourselves." So Samuel called upon the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. All the people said to Samuel, "Pray to the Lord your God for your servants, that we may not die, for we have added to all our sins the evil of demanding a king for ourselves." And Samuel said to the people, "Do not be afraid. You have done all this evil, yet do not turn aside from following the Lord, but serve the Lord with all your heart. And do not turn aside after useless things that cannot profit or save, for they are useless. For the Lord will not cast away his people for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you a people for himself. Moreover, as for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you, and I will instruct you in the good and the right way. Only fear the Lord and serve him faithfully with all your heart, for consider what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king." Saul was years old when he began to reign, and he reigned and 2 years over Israel. Saul chose 3,000 out of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Mishmat and the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent home to their tents. Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it, And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, Let the Hebrews hear. When all Israel heard that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines, the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal. The Philistines mustered to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. They came up and encamped at Michmash to the end of Beth-Aven. When the Israelites saw that they were in distress, for the troops were hard-pressed, the people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in tombs and in cisterns. Some Hebrews crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul was still at Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. He waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people began to slip away from Saul. So Saul said, Bring the burnt offering here to me, and the offering of well-being, and he offered the burnt offering. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to meet him and salute him. Samuel said, What have you done? Saul replied, When I saw that the people were slipping away from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines were mustering at Michmash, I said, Now the Philistines will come down upon me at Gilgal, and I have not entreated the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. Samuel said to Saul, You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. The Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom will not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him to be ruler over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Samuel left and went on his way to Gilgal. The rest of the people followed Saul to join the army. They went up from Gilgal toward Gibeah of Benjamin. The word of the Lord. Okay, so Samuel gets everybody together. We're not sure where, but it's probably Gilgal. And what you see in chapter 12 is a transition of the role of the prophet now that the monarchy has been fully established. We've already seen how Samuel has transitioned from early on in his life from a priestly role into the classic role of judge, and how that role of judge has sort of been evolving into a role of prophet that we're more familiar with. But now that there's a king, his job description is going to change a little bit. And there's a quotation from MacArthur that's in your notes that I'm just going to read aloud for the benefit of anybody that might be listening online. MacArthur's perception on this is that in the past, Samuel discharged, in the view of the present narrative, a wide variety of duties, both religious and secular. But now with the king in Israel, the duties of the prophet are to be more circumscribed. He has become the figure familiar to us from the prophetic books themselves, who is assigned to play two roles corresponding to the two parts of Samuel's pledge, as the people's intercessor with Yahweh on the one hand, and as the moral conscience of the kingdom on the other. So it's really at this pivotal point where we see the emergence of the prophetic calling as we understand it through the remainder of Hebrew Scripture. And he's explained that, because the king's here, things are going to change. And then he goes on kind of a tirade of self-justification. And the idea here is he's comparing himself with the king. All right? All along he's thought this was a bad idea because God thought it was a bad idea. And you might remember back in chapter 18, verses 11 through 18, when the people first ask for a king, he warns them, this is not a good idea. This king is going to exploit you mercilessly. You will not be happy. Yahweh as your king is more than sufficient. Your covenant is fair. In fact, it's more than fair compared to the obedience required from us. Yahweh provides all that we need. And this king is going to be infinitely worse than the king that you already have. Well, they ignored him. And so basically he says, Now, have I done any wickedness against you? And the word taken keeps reappearing in the text. And, you know, if you've got any problem with me, if I've done you wrong, I want to hear about it right now. And they said, no, actually, you've not taken advantage of us. You've not asked any more than was your due. And he says, then God is our witness. And they said, amen. And so what he's doing here is he's contrasting himself and his role as judge and now prophet with the king who's arrived. And then beginning in six, he returns to the criticism that we've heard before, that essentially in demanding a king, they have betrayed God. And he sort of goes through this now familiar litany of all the things that God has done. You know, we remember from our study of Genesis that Jacob, following his son Joseph down into Egypt, as generations passed and as the pharaohs forgot how Joseph's hard work blessed the Egyptians and saved them from famines, Pharaoh began to have a very negative view of the Hebrews and oppressed them harshly. And God called Moses and his sidekick Aaron to bring them out. Beyond that, after their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness under the leadership of Joshua, Moses' successor, they conquered the promised land and prospered. And despite all of this, they have continually, persistently forsaken God. And they have reaped the consequences of it. They have been punished. Because in breaking their covenant with God, they've disrupted that relationship to such an extent that their ability to receive God's help has been compromised. And you can read about this in Judges if you want. Sisera was the commander of the Canaanite armies. Judges chapter 4 and 5, he gives them a good whipping. The Philistines, Judges chapter 3, specifically verses 12 through 30. But in verses 10 and 11 of 1 Samuel 12, you know, Samuel says, but you know, despite the fact of this, God kept sending people to rescue you, people like Samuel, who got you out of the fix and liberated you and restored you. And again, Samuel is drawing a connection between himself and these hero judges that you can read about in the book of Judges. And he's going to remain faithful to them, as we'll see near the end of the chapter, as an ongoing intercessor on behalf of the people with God. Now, you get to verse 12, and it's a little strange because the people asked for a king. God identified Saul to Samuel. Samuel privately anointed him. Then there was the public acclamation. You'll remember we talked about last week where the tribes drew lots, and then every family of the tribe, of the selected tribe, drew lots, and then every member of that family drew lots, and it was Saul. But he wasn't quite king yet. It was not until he gathered the people to defeat King Nahash the Ammonite relieved the siege of a city that he really sort of came into his own as the king. And in verse 12 it says that it was the threat of King Nahash that led the people to call for a king. Well, that contradicts the earlier text. And the reason for this is that, as we talked about before, especially in our opening session with the introduction, there are lots of textual troubles with both books of Samuel and Kings, in that the oldest manuscripts that we have disagree with one another. And even within those manuscripts, there are sort of two competing ideas about the kingship. On the whole, the majority report is that kingship is bad, because it basically is booting Yahweh out of his rightful place as the sovereign over the people. But at the same time, there's a sense in which, well, the kingship's not all bad. It's kind of an ambivalent thing. And of course, later on in 1 Samuel, as we see the emergence of David and the many wondrous things that he did, which continued through his son Solomon into 1 Kings, that this is in fact the case. So what you see is a sewing together, kind of like a quilt, of these different perspectives. And sometimes that creates sort of herky-jerky moments, anachronisms within the text itself, which can create confusion. So, you know, that's kind of the story with verse 12. And pointing toward this sense of ambivalence that not just the authors of these books had, but also God, to a certain extent, Samuel tells the people, beginning in verse 13, now, you've chosen this king, and things can be all right, but you have to realize who the real king is. You have to obey the commandments, and if you do, you and the king will be all right. Even though it's a bad idea, you'll be all right. But if you don't, then things will go badly for you. And to emphasize this and his continuing power as a prophet, beginning in verse 16, Samuel performs a sign. Now, at one level, this isn't terribly impressive. Samuel calls upon God to bring a thunderstorm. And, you know, that could have happened naturally. You could argue that that was a coincidence. But the detail is it not the wheat harvest today? Now, in that part of the world, the wheat harvest was usually brought in May and June. Because remember, it's a more temperate climate than our own. And so you can harvest earlier and even have two planting seasons for some crops. It's really dry in May and June. I mean, it rains very rarely, and that's a good thing if you're harvesting wheat. That's the last thing you want is a lot of rain when you're harvesting wheat. Sorry, farm boy in action on you here. And so he calls down this thunderstorm. It happens, and because of the rarity of it, people see it as a supernatural intervention, God's answer to Samuel's call. And they are scared to death. And so the people say, please pray to God, because we realize that we made a mistake in asking for a king. And again, in verse 20, Samuel gives them encouragement. He says, you know, you're right. What you did was terribly wicked. But if you stay faithful to the covenant, it'll be okay. You got to stay focused. And these useless things that he's talking about could be anything, but it probably refers to idolatry, because we've already seen a reference to that in verse 10, where they worship the Baals and the Astartes. And we're about to see another sort of veiled reference to their persistent practice of idolatry in just a few verses. And because in verse 22, he says, he's not going to get rid of you for his great name's sake, because it has pleased the Lord to make you a people for himself. And within the ongoing context of Exodus, which we see in chapter 12, where the Exodus story is explicitly mentioned, but also consistently behind, underneath the text, if you will, this reference in verse 22 probably is a hearkening back to the episode in Exodus where Moses is up on the mountain, he's getting the law, the people think that maybe he's abandoned them or he's dead and he's not coming back, and so they appeal to Aaron to make a golden calf which they worship, and God sees it and gets so mad and he says to Moses, you are not going to believe what these people have done, I'm going to smite them all. And Moses says, wait a minute, you're going to have a big PR problem if you do that, because the Egyptians to whom you showed your glory will say, okay, so this God who rescued these people took them out in the wilderness just to slaughter them. You know, so you're going to be compromising you know, your success and demonstrating your glory to the Egyptians if you do that. And then verse 23, he says, you know, I'm motivated not just by my compassion for you, but because by not executing my office of prophet faithfully, by continuing to pray for you to the Lord, that would be a betrayal of my special covenant with God. And in addition, I will continue to let you know which ways are right and which ways are wrong. And that pretty much wraps up chapter 12. You get into 13, and the reason that you have these, is it ellipses? Is that what the dot, dot, dot is? That's ellipses, yeah. So you have these ellipses, and the reason is textual corruption. So we don't know how old he was when he became king, and we don't really know how long he reigned. It says 2 years, but the reason the ellipses occur before that is obviously there was a word that became, that came before and to. So it might have been 10 in 2 years or 20 in 2 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's possible he just reigned 2 years. But again, because of the condition of the text, and this is uniform. So you have these texts that really don't agree with each other in so many ways, but almost all of the texts in this instance don't say. And they probably don't say because they don't know. And when they don't know, they're not willing to make it up. So you get that, which is just not helpful. And then Saul pulls together 3,000 people, divides them into groups of 2,000 and 1,000. And, of course, this is a much smaller number than he assembled before. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people. If you take the text literally and don't accept that it could be exaggerated or whatnot. And this would be a more reasonable number of people. Jonathan goes off with his 1,000, defeats the garrison of the Philistines at Geba, and obviously the Philistines are not too happy about it. Saul literally trumpets the news of the victory, but then they realize the Philistines are going to want to get us back. And so the Philistines put together a massive army. Chariots, the ancient version of a tank. They've got horsemen, so they've got cavalry, and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. And I'm sure that phrase is familiar because that's what God promised to Abraham. Your descendants will be more numerous than the stars in the heaven. Like the sands of the seashore, they'll be uncountable. So the message here is this is a massive, overwhelming force coming down on the Israelites in retaliation for their defeat of a Philistine garrison. They're scared to death. And so the Israelites run away and hide any place they can find. Some of them even cross the Jordan to the eastern side where Gad and Reuben are. And, you know, that was a disputed territory with the Ammonites. And so it's a kind of a sign of their desperation that they're willing to take that risk. Now, the Ammonites had just taken a pretty good whipping, so they probably weren't hungry for another battle. But these people were scared to death, and it's emphasized at the end of verse 7b, all the people followed him trembling. And I can't blame them. He waits 7 days. And it's interesting because this 7 days that he was told to wait by Samuel actually is in the text in chapter 10, verse 8. And this is another situation where you just have some narrative discontinuity, which is a persistent feature of this text, and you just have to sort of work through it as best as you can. So 7 days, Samuel doesn't show up. And Saul is getting anxious, and he knows that he needs to curry God's favor, because only with God's support can he hope to defeat this enormous Philistine army. So he enters into the role of priest and offers burnt offerings. And when he does that, he crosses a big red line. Okay? It would be like the president, you know, booting out the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and doing that guy's job for a month. Okay, that's how big this red line was. And Samuel does show up, and he's like, what were you thinking? You know, this is not the deal. Because you'll remember in the work that we did when Saul was publicly acclaimed as king by the people near the end of chapter 10, that Saul told the people the rights and duties of the kingship, and he wrote them in a book and laid it up before the Lord. We don't have that book anymore, but presumably based on what we're told here in the middle of chapter 13, one of them is the king shall not act as a priest. Now we're going to see this line crossed in the future without the same sort of negative sanction. But in this case, not good. And because of this, Saul's reign will not last long, and he will not be able to establish a dynasty, which is an interesting judgment, because it's been quite clear from the beginning that God, as the true sovereign, will choose the king, and that succession was not part of the plan. So in a way, this just makes clearer something that was already understood from the beginning, but it's rendered as a judgment. And then it talks about how the Lord's going to pick somebody else, not Jonathan. And we're going to get to that story in a little while, and that's a great story. And there are little hints here about David, but really the emphasis is on the sovereignty of God to choose whom he pleases be king. So Saul's basically told, having done this, you are doomed. And Saul leaves, and so does, Samuel leaves, and then so does Saul with what's left of his army. And they go from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and then starting in verse 15b and running throughout verse 14, we read about the battle with the Philistines. So that's what I got for you in that chapter and a half. So what do you guys have? I know you're seeing things that I don't, as you do every week. You might have questions where I've not been entirely clear.
We may have covered this before. I'm sorry if we have.
No worries.
Did Saul have military training?
Well, everybody would have had some level of military training, including Saul, because after the conquest, the tribes were regularly at war with their neighbors. I mean, they were surrounded by people who were hostile to their existence, very much like today. And so these tribes, under the leadership of judges, would often band together for limited periods of time, not all 12 of them together, but neighboring tribes to ward off a shared threat. And all able-bodied men would have been expected to participate in these militias. So Saul would have had military experience and perhaps even as a leader of a discrete unit. But you know, what we talked about last week was that Saul summoning people from all of the tribes of Israel was a rare, if not unique, occurrence when he summoned them against Nahash the Ammonite and his army. And this is what validated his authority as king. You know, in a way, it was the proof of the public profession that had preceded it, that he did indeed have the authority to summon people in a way that the judges before him had not. So,
the authority and maybe the gift of God as a leader.
Yes. I mean, you know, God grudgingly made him king. But, you know, as we've read today in chapter 12, God's willing to help this work out if the people will be faithful. But it's a big if. And based on the prior pattern, I think we all know that they're not going to be able to resist idolatry, that they're not going to be able to obey God's commandments. And so, I mean, you know, barring a radical turnaround, the kingship is doomed. But in a way, God's willing to give it a chance. That's sort of the message that Samuel gives to the people. And in the battle against Nahash, Saul did show remarkable organizational capacity. He is dealing with a large force of people. He quickly assembles them, divides them into three coherent units, and then executes a very difficult military maneuver. You know, when a city's under siege, what you want to do is envelop the enveloping siege lines and then puncture them. And once you've punctured them at a specific place, the advantage you get is you've opened up two flanks and you can get into the rear of that army. And so in the meantime, the other two units, you form three units, the other two units are creating an enveloping maneuver so that nobody gets away. And in the meantime, so they're pressing in on the front of the besieging armies while their flanks are being rolled up. They've got enemy troops in their rear, and it is just a total nightmare. And as we read last week, the slaughter was so great that there weren't even enough people left for them to run away in pairs. You know, so it was a difficult maneuver, beautifully executed, and certainly all good gifts come from God, but whether we use them effectively is to a certain extent up to us. So Saul earned his shoulder pips, and you know, certainly did have the capacity. Didn't always mean he was going to win, though, because sometimes defeat is God's judgment and punishment for wicked people.
What comes to my mind listening to all these war details is ISIS and the attempts to push them back, and last clip out of a couple of days ago, okay, they got them out of the area, they're trying to get them out of it, and but they're insidious.
Yeah.
And they'll be back, no matter who's leading the opposition. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it's the whole, that's our history. That's the world's history.
Well, yeah.
In the Bible, in this book.
Yeah, asymmetrical warfare, you know, has a very, very long history. And oftentimes it's more effective than conventional warfare. You know, we talked quite a lot in our previous study of Mark about the rebellion of 66 that culminated in the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. For generations prior to that, there was an ongoing guerrilla war happening. Assassinations, banditry on the roads, attacking Roman columns, things like that. And it was when the people actually united into a coherent military force that they made themselves vulnerable to the Roman army, which was larger, better equipped, better trained, and better disciplined. You know, so if you don't have the advantage in the conventional sense, then the smart thing to do is to practice asymmetrical warfare. And, you know, it's dirty, but if you're relatively weak, it's necessary. I mean, the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War, it was very effective. Very effective.
The paragraph at the bottom of the first page, McCarter's comment, they always get to the king. They're not the understood king, as it is in the larger narrative.
Yes.
As a unique kind of divine condescension. Well, anyway, he says, okay, you've been wicked, you want a king, all right, I'll give you a king. But it is really here in this chapter and a half is another, it's shown as, his king is shown as God's provision to deliver Israel in spite of
Yeah, I mean, God chose the king, and he's willing to give a go of it, even though God knows it's not going to turn out well. I mean, it's kind of a doom project from the start, but God, through Samuel, is trying to let people know this is what's going to be required for this whole monarchy thing to work. But because we know their history, it's very clear what eventually is going to happen. It's going to take a long time. It's going to take a process of centuries before the monarchy collapses and, you know, the sort of final punishment of conquest and exile by the Assyrians and Babylonians occur. But the quotation that Judy's referencing from McCarter at the bottom of the first page, because I'm just going to read this aloud, forgive me, again for the benefit of the people who may be listening online, to explain verse 12 of chapter 12, he wrote, "The new slant given by the assertion that the people made their demand in response to the Ammonite threat is quite important, inasmuch as it forces a different interpretation of the inauguration of the kingship. Yahweh's gift of a king cannot be understood here, as it is in the larger narrative, as a unique act of divine condescension in response to a wicked and willful human act, but rather it must here be interpreted as another gracious provision for Israel's deliverance from deserved danger." So see, there's this ambivalence within the text reflecting an ambivalence with God. He doesn't want to give them a king, but he relents. Why? Well, because he loves them. And if, you know, maybe, I mean, it's God is ever hopeful. God is ever hopeful that the people will repent, amend their lives, and by and large avoid sin to the extent that any human being is capable. And that is the faithfulness, the steadfast faithfulness of God, which is something that should give all of us great hope. You know, because we can't look down our noses at the Israelites. I mean, in a way, their desire for the king was idolatry. And they practiced idolatry in other ways. And all of us practice idolatries. We all have on our list of priorities things up at number one that aren't God. Whether it's our physical safety or our financial security or our favorite football team or, you know, you name it. There are things that we put in front of God all the time. In fact, sometimes he doesn't even make the top ten. That's all idolatry, you know. And so the message that I receive in terms of my life of faith from 1 Samuel is that even when I'm not trying hard, or even when I'm trying hard and I fail to stay faithful, God never stops trying to reconcile the relationship. God will not give up on me or on any of us.
Spiritual director talks at Crusader, you know, we're always concentrating on belief in God. Mm-hmm. Yet God believes in us.
Yeah.
He believes in us. He believes that we will love him, that we will. And as I told you once before, I think our only true gift to God, our only true gift is the attempt, is to try to be what he wants us to be, is to try. That's our gift.
Yes. I mean, it's like in the baptismal covenant, after we've done the Apostles' Creed in question and answer format, stating the core of our belief, you know, if you believe something, you're going to do something about it. So what follows are five questions. And the answer to each one is, I will, with God's help, which is an acknowledgement of our intent and the necessity of our effort to not only answer those questions with our lips, but with our lives, but the reality that without God's grace, we don't stand a chance. So it's about receiving and honoring and deploying God's grace in our lives so that our attempts can be fruitful to some extent. But we're sinful, we're limited, and it's inevitable. We're going to screw up. It's just going to happen. It's no excuse, but it's going to happen. John?
You know, Michael, I sense here as Saul leaves at the end, leaves as a beaten man, not feeling good about himself.
Oh, definitely not.
All right. Would anybody had succeeded, let's say somebody else was picked, or was the message that God was trying to give her, give, was you really don't need a king, you know, this is one of the deals. Because to me, it seemed like Saul was a good choice.
Yeah.
But the reality is, could anyone have pulled this thing off?
You know, that's an intriguing question because, you know, it makes me wonder, did God, in his opposition to the kingship, intentionally pick a stinker in Saul? You know, did he basically set this poor man up to fail? Which we'll see in subsequent chapters over the next 2 or 3 weeks. Saul fails miserably. I mean, and he really becomes the anti-David, you know. And part of the story of Saul is to set up the emergence of David as the good king, as the realization of what the kingship can be. But, you know, it's hard to say if there was anybody else who would have been better qualified or more faithful than Saul. You know, and one does have to wonder if the motive behind choosing Saul was that there were certain character flaws that would expose the foolishness of asking for a king. Because remember, the only qualification given for Saul becoming king is, look at how tall he is. He's so much taller than everybody else. You know, there's nothing like, this is a wise man, he's a pious man, he's a generous man, he's a smart guy. It's just like, wow, he's tall. Did I answer that?
Yeah,
with,
I mean,
some
I
measure
think,
of adequacy.
I don't think there's an answer. I think one will say you never know.
You just wonder about it, though.
Don't you wonder, do wonder about it. Who else could have stopped it?
Yeah. No, I think anybody would have been doomed simply because they were walking to an office that God half-heartedly sanctioned at best.
That's right.
And trying to take the place of Yahweh as king, I mean, nobody can do that. Nobody can do that. Let's see a hand over here.
I was thinking that all of those men, David had his faults and Moses had his faults. They all had faults, but God stuck by them.
Yes. I mean, God consistently chooses flawed people to execute his will in the world. Mainly because God doesn't have any choice. We're all deeply flawed. But for whatever reason, God does seem to have a tendency to choose exuberantly flawed people. You know, he chose Jacob over Esau. And, you know, Jacob was a liar and a cheat. He chose Moses, who was a murderer. He picked David, who he was a wild child, we'll put it like that. You know, and on and on and on. Or you can think about in the New Testament, you know, the apostle to the Gentiles, you know, was first a persecutor of Christians, or the disciples that Jesus chose. Simple fishermen who, despite their spending all their days with Jesus, didn't understand who he was until after the resurrection, and abandoned him at the crucial point when he was seized. And that makes me feel better in a twisted kind of way, because I'm not saying I'm any better than Saul or the original disciples or Moses or David or any of the biblical figures. Quite the contrary. I would be terrified to be put in the position that they were. But it gives me hope that, you know, God can work through me despite all the flaws in my character. And, you know, I can run down the wrong road and, you know, eventually, gently or not so gently, I'll be led back to the right path, and that God can work good in me. And that's true for every single one of us. Every single one of us. You know, when you beat up on yourself, you're denying God's power to transform you and to work through you even in your worst moments. So I appreciate you raising that point. Oh, it's central to the Christian faith, because only God can judge. And the real danger when someone judges is that you put yourself in a position of superiority. And when you put yourself in that role, then the natural impulse is to seek vengeance against the judged, which God reserves as a sole privilege. And to the extent that we can be honest with ourselves about our own sinfulness, we can be more understanding and forgiving of the sins of others when they offend against us. you know, it's...
But more often than not, we look at others' failings and compare ourselves to them as a way of being good about ourselves.
Yes.
And not that we're going to condemn or do anything about the person. We're just stuck in our own world.
Yeah, I mean, you look at other people and, you know, leave it to the Germans to have a word for this, and we feel a great deal of Schadenfreude, you know, which basically means to enjoy the suffering of other people. And what we do is we enjoy not just the suffering of the other people, but their debasement, and try to make ourselves feel better by comparison. That's a tempting coping mechanism to sort of drown the sorrows that you feel by your own pangs of conscience by saying, well, at least I'm not as bad as so-and-so. But Jesus had a little nifty saying about that in terms of the speck in another's eye. Well, you got a 2x4 stuck in your own. And so... I think one of the hardest parts of the Christian faith is that we have to subject ourselves to continual self-scrutiny, and we have to be honest about the ugliness, you know.
See, but that's how my faith gets stronger, because I realize all the imperfections of the relationships that I have with people, you know, and hurtful things that they might say or do. Then I turn to God, and my faith in God becomes stronger, because I know God's love is a perfect love and an everlasting love. And that takes precedence over, you know, any relationship that I have with.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's when you're not feeling the love from the people around you, taking refuge in the knowledge that God's love is endless, it's an immensely healing experience. And also recognizing that, you know, God's love for us is an in spite of type of love. That God isn't a spiteful God. God is a in spite of God. And so whatever we do, we can be honest with ourselves about it and work toward repenting, literally turning our lives around, because we know the acceptance of God's love. And that's the only way that, without a consciousness of God's never-failing love, consistent, fearless self-scrutiny is not possible. You know, we just can't face our failings if we don't believe that God will redeem them.
Redeems them through our faith in Jesus Christ.
Absolutely. I mean, It's our faith relationship that opens up our hearts to the grace that grants us the wisdom to perceive our own shortcomings, our sins, and also to perceive that through Jesus an avenue has been created where we can continually seek and receive forgiveness. And so you lose touch with that, and you either are miserable, option A, misery, option B, you live in an illusion, you know.
What helps me is that knowing that I always have God with me and a grace that helps me face the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can say, you keep going forward.
Yeah.
This sort of changes the subject, but what's going on in Israel right now?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why someone's so angry. That, mm-hmm. Why are they so angry that our president has said, you know, this should be the capital?
I
don't understand the anger.
Yeah, the anger around the... affirmation of Israel's claim that Jerusalem is their eternal capital,
mm-hmm.
Is that when the State of Israel was created by United Nations mandate in 1948, Jerusalem was designated as a neutral city. But in the subsequent wars, especially in the 1967 war, parts of Jerusalem were captured by the Israeli Defense Forces, and the occupation has continued. And Jerusalem is divided into essentially two halves, one of which is under Israeli control, and the other part of which is under Palestinian control. And so I think the disturbance has to do with the fact that, you know, declaring Jerusalem without qualification as the capital of Israel sort of invalidates the presence and authority of the Palestinians in a section of the city. And I think that, from my personal perspective, a more productive approach, if in fact we're seeking a peace process that will lead to a two-state solution, would be to say that Jerusalem is the capital of both Israel and the Palestinian Authority, so that you have a measure of equality there. I think that that is what's created the disturbance, is that this symbolic gesture, which was very pleasing to our ally, Israel, was also a very dangerous symbolic gesture in terms of the sense of injustice that many Palestinians feel around this very one-sided declaration, and the risk that it creates of a third intifada, and all the violence and death and disruption that comes with that. But there's a regional geopolitical reordering in that area, essentially between Shia and Sunni Muslim, and it's very complex, and no strategic motive was given for the president's declaration. So there might be motivations that are revealed over time, that this is a tactic in a broader plan, but that plan isn't currently evident to me. So,
why wouldn't you just divide Jerusalem based on that? I mean, did that with Korea, is it north and the south?
Yeah, well, that worked out great, dividing Korea. Yeah.
But what I'm saying, though, is same with Vietnam. There was the north and the south Vietnam. Yeah. Why would you not just divide Jerusalem? Mm-hmm. So this group is happy, this group is happy, and then maybe over time
they'll get together.
They'll get together rather than, because right now, I mean, we're never going to get
together. This is, what is this, 2017? It hadn't happened in a couple years.
But that doesn't mean it shouldn't happen.
Well, yeah. Of course not, but I should grow hair too, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, I mean, it, both sides want all of it, and they're not going to be happy with what they see as half a loaf, and you know, the hope would be that they would reconcile themselves that something is better than nothing.
Exactly.
But I think both sides are confident that eventually they will be able to attain the fullness of their goals, their territorial goals. And
in actuality, the it's only one third the amount. The division.
Yeah, it's always, you know, it's not half and half.
It's not half and half.
Yeah. But
it's easy to see. I mean, European and olive growth farmer, Palestinian olive growth farmer for 30 uh-huh. generations.
Yes.
And suddenly the United Nations say, well, your olive farm's going to be taken over by a Jewish man from Russia. Mm-hmm. And they're dumped on them, and you know, you're supposed to accept that as well. Okay, it's God's will.
Yeah.
So, yeah. The whole thing is flawed Churchill was one of the greatest members.
Yeah, well, and, you know, the truth of the matter is that the unrest in the Middle East has, at the very least, been aided and abetted by the self-interest of great powers who ham-fistedly, I mean, we're coming up on the one-century anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. Are you guys familiar with the Balfour Declaration? Basically, the current boundary lines of Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, more or less, and the entire region, after World War I, and they went into this agreement before the war was even done, so that they'd be ready once it was over if they did win. And they basically said, well, let's slice this up. And France, you can sort of have control over this part, and, you know, Britain, you can have control over this part. And a lot of it was about oil. And the lines were drawn almost completely arbitrarily, with no regard for religion or ethnicity or anything else, which is why you have this toxic blend of Kurds and Sunni and Shia Muslims all contained within these tidy, straight boundary lines in Iraq. Part of it was born out of ignorance, and part of it was they just didn't care. They wanted what they wanted, and that was that. And, of course, the drive toward creating an Israeli state in Palestine wasn't an invention in the wake of World War II. Zionism really began in the late 19th century, motivated by a variety of different things, but in large part by systemic pogroms in Russia and the need for there to be a restoration and a place where Jewish people could have some measure of physical security. And then, of course, in the wake of World War II and the Shoah, the world's responsible act was to finally provide that state. But it was handled in a very cruel way. So I'm not saying there shouldn't be an Israeli state. I think there should be. I just think that the execution of its creation was hardly unfair to the Palestinian people. So I totally understand their resentment, but I also understand, I mean, I understand both sides of the argument, which sometimes is an extremely frustrating place to be. But because they both have fair points. And, you know, whoever cleans that mess up is a shoo-in for the Nobel Peace Prize. So, you know, so get cracking. Get cracking, because it's up to about 10 million krona, I think, which is around $1 million US. So.
Well, you know, the Dome of the Rock sits right there in the middle of Holland, and it has claims of the three major religions.
Yep.
And it's kind of the dividing line. It's really Muslim territory.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you have Israeli guards upon the dome, upon the area, to protect their people down at the Wailing Wall.
Yeah.
Because the Muslims were stoning them.
Yeah.
Over, you know, over the wall. So you have Israeli soldiers up there, even though it's really not their territory.
Hmm.
But they're up there to protect their people. And you have very strict admission into that area from tourists and everything. Because we got hung up in the bar mitzvah celebration, although the classic Methodist had to sing an extra song over there on the teaching steps. We didn't get into the Dome of the Rock.
Oh my goodness, really?
Well, and, you know, you just look at all that and, you know, without passing judgment, because Christians, as we've discussed before, are involved in this conflict. It's just hard to see that this is what God had in mind. As the psalmist wrote, we all need to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. It's coming on 11 o'clock, so we'll meet again next Wednesday, and we'll do the remainder of chapter 13 and the entirety of chapter 14. And then the Wednesday after Christmas we'll take off, and then we'll resume the first Wednesday of the new year. Why don't we say the Our Father together? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thanks for another great day, and have...
And thanks for covering some other things.